Welcome to The Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter. And our topic today is going to be a Vietnam story. But let me set the stage for you a little bit. When I was younger, there was no black and white movie came on. It was a World War II movie. And at the end, at the time, it was about the Battle of the Bulge. But at the end, there were about 10 or 12 ragtag American soldiers that marched off. And when they saw some new soldiers coming in, they snapped to attention and did their best march as they went by them. But they had been fighting for days during the Battle of the Bulge. And when the movie was over, I thought, hey, that was a great war movie. And I never thought about the fact that those 10 soldiers were, although they could walk off the battlefield, they may have been wounded in many ways and how that affected their lives or what went on. And then it made me think about when I was younger, when I would play with my Army men, I would go in and set them all up, and then I'd knock some down. And I would never think about what was really going on in that life or how that affected that family. Sometimes I'd stand them back up, or I'd have my favorite Army man, I'd never let him get hurt. But it never crossed my mind about when I was playing that there were real families and things like that involved, and that those folks needed to go home. So that's sort of what we're going to be talking about today. Our guest is Mr. Howard Jenkins. How you doing today, Mr. Jenkins?
Cup runneth over.
Well, good, good. So we're going to be covering those topics today. We're going to take you to Vietnam in a particular battle in a place called Phu Nang.
Or L.Z. Miller.
L.Z. Miller. We're going to talk about that battle and what happened, and then we're talking about one of the soldiers that came out of that battle and what happened, and then we're going to be talking about his life as he began to change those negative effects and turn them into positives. He served in the Army from 1969 to 1971. Welcome, Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you were doing before you went into the military?
Well, I was going to school. I'd been to Trevecca Nazarene College for 2 years, and then I transferred to Belmont University across town. This is in Nashville. I was 25 years old. I basically thought the draft was going to pass me by.
Well, you were 6 years older than an average draftee.
That's a fact, I was. In fact, in some of the fire bases I was on, I was older than the officers.
They didn't start calling you Pop, did they?
Well, they had a guy there they called Pop, and he was only 28. I was
really?
25.
So you talked a little bit about getting your notice.
Well, I'd been through several physicals. I'd gotten to 25. I'd had several deferments. I figured everything, you know, this war was going to pass me by. I'd seen it on the news. Hadn't paid much attention to it, and I was living in a mobile home park where they have all these mailboxes. And I went down there, and I knew this notice was going to come in one of those yellow or manila envelopes, you know. I guess yellow is more correct, or orange. Before I opened the box, I just said to myself, I said, this is the big one. And when I pulled that letter out, I sat down there. I didn't open it. I just sat down there, and I thought about it. I said, this is the big one. And it was. It was basically my draft notice. I don't remember whether they told me in there that I had an opportunity to go volunteer or not. But my dad was Air Force recruiter. It had been for 5 or 6 years, in fact, right here in Knoxville. And I knew I had that option, so that's what I did. I went down and got on a 90-day delayed enlistment so I could graduate from college.
But you didn't go in the Air Force.
No. There was a stronger possibility of becoming an officer in the Army at that time. The Air Force wanted me to enlist and then wait. And I didn't want to wait. I knew some guys that had waited for 5 or 6 years and finally got out and never got their commissions.
Uh-huh. So you went in June of 1969.
That's correct.
That was a year after the Democratic Convention. The Vietnam War had already changed American society.
That's right. There was a lot of protesting going on.
Had it changed you?
Well, my dad, having been in the service, and in fact, he spent 24 years in the Air Force and retired, I felt like that it was the right thing to do. I bought into the domino theory. In other words, if Southeast Asia fell, Asia would fall. If Asia fell, Europe would fall. And I felt like it was my duty to serve.
So what were you trained to be before you went to the Army? You said you graduated from college.
I got a degree in business administration with minors in psychology and economics. I wanted to get an aviation maintenance management.
Aviation maintenance management. But the Army had different ideas.
Oh, yeah. They wanted me to shoot the big gun.
Okay, the big gun. When you say the big gun.
155 Howitzer.
A 155, that is a big gun.
Well, that's the towed unit like they used in World War II. In fact, some of those guns, I don't know if they date back that far or not. But
could you shoot into Cambodia?
Not where I was. We had about a 13-mile range, and I think everything we shot was strictly within Vietnam itself.
Were you at the Ho Chi Minh Trail or troop concentrations? Or
Our primary function was to follow the engineers as they moved south and fire support for them. And we had a sister platoon. Two of us would move at a time, or one of us would move at a time. We would leapfrog going south, one jump over the other within our range, probably 10 to 12 miles, just far enough so we could shoot what they call delta tangos or defensive targets. They were standard targets. We might just shoot them in the middle of the night for no reason, just thinking the enemy might be there.
It's like playing Battleship.
There you go. That's it.
Okay. And then, but you went in 69, but you didn't make it to Vietnam until 71 or 70?
I got there in 70.
What were they training you before you went to Vietnam? What was the Army training you to do? Was it all artillery? Or?
Well, they train you in various things. My secondary MOS was survey, which relates to artillery. Mm-hmm. You might have to survey what they call a registration point. In other words, a known point, and then you would, like a rifle, you would sight it in. With a howitzer, you'd zero in on that target so that you know that the data and the correction. Some of those howitzers, they don't always fire exactly where you want them to. They're very close. Mm-hmm. But this is a fine-tuning of the howitzer registration point, so that's why your secondary MOS might very well be survey.
So your patch said artillery?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Were you trained in the methods of the infantry?
No. When you go into the Army, or at least when you went in at that time, you chose a combat arms. You either went in the infantry, artillery, or armor. And my philosophy was, I don't want to get that close to the enemy in the infantry, and I don't want to be in that middle box. Yeah. So I picked the middle ground. I took the artillery. That's one of the advantages of volunteering, too. You get a little more option as to what you can do.
You weren't maintenance of the gun.
No, I was in fire direction control. I computed the data for the howitzers to fire. We'd pick a point on the map. We'd have a map man. He would give us an elevation, which would mean a correction for the gun based on the height of the mountain or a valley, which you have to make a correction for. We'd have a radio man that would get the data from the forward observer. And I've done all those jobs. Plus, at that time of the attack, I was the chief computer or the lead NCO in the fire direction control unit. I would actually compute the data, make all the corrections, give them to the radio man, and he would send them to the howitzer, and that's what they put on the howitzer, and then they'd shoot. And all this is done very rapidly.
So all along, most of the time you felt pretty safe that you had a defensive perimeter around you and were well protected or defended?
I did in that respect. My fear was when I got there, and I think this was part of the problem that I had to deal with, was you would go for days at a time, weeks at a time, months at a time, and never even get a mortar round inside your compound or even get shot at. The guys were so complacent. They were much younger than I was. I think I'd been through more than they'd been through. I was 6 years older than most of them. And my fear was that let me put it this way. I heard stories where the guys became so complacent that in one fire base, the VC put their guns on their shoulders, actually marched into the compound in their black pajamas, and guys just stood there and looked at them. They thought, you know, this can't happen, that this can't be going on, but that type of thing.
Or that it was something else other than what they saw.
Right, and the fact that I'm in what they call the TOC, or the Tactical Operations Center. I've got the radios to communicate with the rear areas. If they ever got inside the wire, that's what they want to destroy first. They destroy the electricity. They destroy the communications. They destroy the data to the howitzers. We can't fire for the unit down the road. And that unit was being hit at the same time we were being hit.
Destroy the electricity and get inside the wire.
There you go.
Now, was this one wire?
Oh, they had several layers of this concertina wire that you see around a lot of prisons.
Mm-hmm.
Barbed wire, mostly concertina wire. That's much harder to get through than the barbed wire. There were probably, at our fire base, probably four rows of it. Plus, they had trip wires out there. But I've seen these guys work. I've seen them work in the daytime. These sappers that would come in, I've stood there and watched them in the daytime. And if you're not looking right at them and you don't know what they're doing or who they are, you don't know they're there. They were that good. These are just small guys that they take little sticks and they push that concertina wire out and they put don't just what place to put it in and they just slip through there like a snake almost.
Wow. You know, these days where you hear in Afghanistan where the snipers are taking people out at 2 and 3 miles, so were there not snipers?
I guess there were, but I never experienced any of them on a fire base.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe once in a while we'd get a shot from something, but nothing to really – you wouldn't really call them snipers, so to speak. They were just, I think, just shooting at us in general.
It wasn't like that every day. There were a couple of days where it got tense and there was a battle.
That's true.
Do you remember what that date was?
No, and I should because I just came back from a reunion, but that's one of the things that PTSD does to you. You have a tendency to forget dates and things like
that's
that.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this question. It was complacent and everybody was doing everything. At some time, did you feel like a battle was building? Or, I mean, not because you could hear it, but just could you feel that things were changing and everything was about to break loose? Or was it just all of a sudden a surprise that just happened all at once?
Well, it started about midnight. I'd just gone off shift. I don't think we had any idea. In fact, we had Vietnamese women that were taking our laundry down to this little river and cleaning it, and they had to walk right through the area where these VC were built up, and they never gave us any idea that this was going on. It was a complete, total surprise.
Okay. Mr. Jenkins, we got you out of civilian life and into the military, and we talked about it, and we got you into Vietnam and near a base, I'm having trouble pronouncing it, Phu Nang.
Yeah.
And you said that for a long, long time it was a peaceful, where you almost felt safe or you had a false sense of safety.
Well, what I felt like was I felt like the men that I was serving with had more of a false sense of safety.
Uh-huh.
They'd become complacent. I don't think that was their fault. I think it was just the way things were done, and that was Vietnam. I realize that now. Like I said, my biggest fear was that I'd heard stories about guys becoming so complacent that the VC would actually just march into the firebase. Now, I don't know if these stories were real or if it was things they were telling to keep us alert, but it worked on my mind. It was on my mind all the time.
Okay.
When I went out, got on the firebase, I thought to myself, if they come in on the north, am I going to be able to get out on the south?
Okay.
If it comes to that.
Yeah. Earlier, when we were talking about the show a little bit, you talked about a song that you heard a lot, Inagata De Vida. I mean, tell me about what you remember about that.
Well, of course, I was from Knoxville,
mm-hmm.
and my dad was from Knoxville. I grew up here, I guess, more with country music. And the guys over there, they were in that, I guess you'd call it the heavy metal era, so to speak.
Rock and roll.
I was an Elvis fan, and they were like Iron Butterfly. I can't think of some of the other groups then that were real popular.
Uh-huh.
The Who, I guess, was another one. They were more into that, and I think they played that Inagata De Vida, I think, for my benefit, because they knew I didn't particularly care for it.
Daytime, and you've just been doing your job, and then you get down to a point where the sun is starting to set. You're thinking tomorrow's going to be another day. You had just gone to bed.
It was about midnight, as I recall. And the small arms fire woke me. And we'd heard small arms fire before. We'd had a few mortars dropped on us from different fire bases. I'd been at Wake Davis and Pleiku and things like that happened. But somehow I knew it was like the letter from the draft board. I knew something was going on. Something was different. I could hear hollering and screaming. Or not screaming necessarily, but I could hear the guys hollering. Go here, go there. I could hear my officers giving directions. I could hear mortars. And I knew we were in a serious situation. And I got up, me and a fellow by the name of Michael Ford from Kingsport, Tennessee. We went in our shorts and T-shirts.
When you say in?
Into the fire direction control.
Okay.
In which we lived right behind. We lived in a hooch about 40 foot long, and we had about 15 foot of it was fire direction control, and the rest was living quarters. And that was part of the problem. But anyway.
Well, what did you say now? A hooch is a shed.
Underground. It's got about maybe 2 foot of circulation just above ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's so high you can't see out of it, but somebody outside could see in it.
Mm-hmm. And then fire direction control, was that another bunker?
That was our office. That was like the TOC, or Tactical Operations Center, and Fire Direction Control all in one.
Was it underground?
It's part of the hooch.
Oh, it's part of the hooch.
Yeah, it's like a 15-foot piece of it, and then you got about 25 or 30 feet behind there where the officers bunked and where fire direction control bunked. Now, the fellas on the guns, they had their own hooch. They bunked together.
Okay. Now, was that a 24-hour living quarters?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
you did
so,
everything in there. Yeah.
Okay. So other people weren't sleeping in the daytime while you were working in the same hooch. It was just it was your personal.
Well, hooch. we had two shifts. We worked 12-hour shifts. Now, I just worked from I worked from 12 noon to 12 midnight. I kind of give the guys the choice of what shift they wanted. Most of them wanted to work the night shift. So I'd take 12 noon to midnight, and they'd get midnight till 12 noon. And I'd just gone to bed on them, just pulled the day shift. Me and Michael Ford had just pulled the day shift, and we'd just gone to bed when it started.
And what is it you would be doing during the day?
Well, they had things like they called just basically administrative work or paperwork. They had what they called a MET, which allowed the artillery rounds or allowed an artillery piece to adjust for the atmospheric conditions. That would come in a couple of times a day, and you'd make those adjustments. You had a form you'd fill out, which allowed for a correction to put on the guns. Some of the guys would go out and work in the wire, doing things in the perimeter. Guys on the guns had various jobs that they performed every day.
At 12:30 or whenever the fight started, there was already somebody doing your job. Is that correct?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
So what did you do?
Well, as soon as we got up, we went in and took their job. We didn't even bother to dress. We took their job, and they went outside to do guard duty or whatever needed to be done out there. We had a sandbag bunker on top of the FDC. One of them would man that, and then one of them would go out on the perimeter.
Now, did you outrank them?
I was a Spec 5 at that time. I was the chief computer of fire direction control. I was the head NCO in FDC. Okay. I had just recently gotten that position.
So you've gone in and you've taken this new position. What was going on in your mind then? What were you expecting, or what did you think? Or?
Well, it was probably the scariest time of my life. I could hear all the small arms fire. I could hear mortars. I could hear the guys hollering out there. I could hear various things going on, and I had no idea what was going on. I'm sitting there with Michael Ford, and my knees are shaking. My teeth are chattering literally like it was cold and sweat's running off of it. And I looked at Michael. I said, "It's cold tonight, isn't it?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Michael, it's not cold. We're scared to death, aren't we?" And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah." And that was one of the things that really bothered me. I'm sitting there thinking I've got 25 feet of darkness behind me in this fire direction control bunker. My biggest fear was a satchel charge that they would drop in there. Now, if it come into the fire direction control where it was lit, I'm wondering, what will I do? Will I pick it up? Will I throw it out? Will I freeze? Will I tell Michael, let's get out of here? But the worst part was, if they threw it back there where it was dark, I couldn't see it. I kept listening. We're sitting there firing Delta Tangos or firing support for the firebase, our sister firebase. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do if they put that in the back? Well, the next day I found out that that's what they were trying to do. And one of the South Vietnamese soldiers shot the guy that was headed for the fire direction control.
Where you were?
Where I was. I go outside and they had that next day when it got daylight, they had looked like maybe a culvert that had been cut about 3 foot high, 3 foot in diameter, and that's where they threw all the unexploded ordnance. And I look in there and I see there's that satchel charge. And then I hear one of the officers say they were headed toward the fire direction control, and that was one of my worst fears. That was my first shock right there. Actually, my second shock. The first one was all that going on outside when I was inside the fire direction control, and the second one was seeing that satchel charge that I had feared.
Well, now, you weren't doing paperwork. You said you did paperwork in your job, so you were actually – were you on the radio – I mean, did you have to stay where you were, or could you go out and fight? Or,
well, part of our job would be call the rear area and tell them we're under attack.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some serious firing going on, and they'd say something like, "Are you sure?" And I'd take that mic and key it. I said, "Listen to that." And I'd hold it open and let them hear that fire. And they'd get back and open and said, "Yeah, we got choppers on the way." And they did. We probably wouldn't have made it if they hadn't sent those choppers out there. They sent Cobras out there, and they were firing so close to the compound that the metal links that were holding the rounds together were falling inside the compound. And this compound's probably only 40 foot wide and maybe 80 feet long. And those links were falling inside. I could hear them hitting the roof. I mean, hitting the top of the FDC, and I didn't know what they were at the time.
So they were just, choppers were right overhead.
Oh, yeah.
Were they Viet Cong or North Vietnamese Army?
Well, we found out later that there was 300 of them or more out there. And there were only 28 guys on a firebase. They were also hitting the firebase down, our sister firebase down the road about 10 clicks. Most North Vietnamese regulars, we learned. I never actually saw one of them.
Okay, so the 300 were attacking two bases?
Two bases at the same time. That's what they'd usually do. And that's why they would put us that close together so we could fire for each other.
Again, not being a veteran, when I read the books of Sun Tzu, they say if you're going to attack with three times the force of the defenders. So you think there were maybe 150 or 300 coming after you?
Oh, they told us there was 300. I have no idea how many were actually out there. I know we probably killed about 10 in the wire that night.
How do you maintain personal discipline when that's going on, when you're scared? Is that a fair question?
Well, that's one thing I can say about military training. They train you for this.
Uh-huh.
That when you get something like that, your primary function is to do your job. Everybody has a job. If everybody does their job, things are going to come out better.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody panics or doesn't do their job, then somebody's got to fill that hole. So we did everybody in my outfit, everybody there did their job. In fact, I talked to the lieutenant that was there that night, and his comment was, first, you saved our lives that night. We had three officers there, but we might as well have had two that they might as well stayed at home. And his comment was, everybody did their job, and that's why we come home. That doesn't mean that the guys that didn't come home didn't do their job, but it means if you do your job, you're more likely to come home. We did everything we were supposed to do. We did it like we were trained, and we had one good leader there that night.
You talked about Michael Ford. And I hear so many veterans in Vietnam talk about old friends. Did you all have nicknames for each other, or did you all call each other by your names or by your ranks? Or,
well, I'd say Michael was probably 18 or 19, but I think we had maybe a closer relationship because he was from Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
He was from Kingsport. And all of us shared things when we would get a care package. But it was especially significant to me when I would get something or he'd get something. There was always something in there from my wife or from his family. He wasn't married. That would maybe remind us of home. So I think we had a camaraderie that, and him being a country boy and and me too, basically.
But you didn't go home at the same time, did you?
No, I think Michael was still there. See, a lot of guys would stay a few extra months so that when they come back, they didn't have any time left in service. I had a wife and I wanted to get out of there. Mm-hmm. I had a year left in service when I come back, so it wouldn't do me. I'd have to stay the whole another year, and I wasn't going to do that.
Did you stay in service for that year?
I had a year to go, but I got a 6 month early out. They were pushing guys out.
Were you feeling the effects of that battle 6 months later?
No, it didn't hit me until about 75. When I divorced my wife.
4 years.
Yeah.
You divorced her. Did she divorce you?
I divorced her. She had put me through college. I'd helped her go. She was going to University of Hawaii. That's where I was when I got divorced. And I just got to the point that I felt like I wasn't really the man that she needed. I couldn't give her what she wanted. In fact, I just came back from Florida a couple of months ago, and for the first time I was able to tell her that it wasn't that I didn't love her. It's just that I loved her so much that I couldn't give her, I thought, what she needed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She was a good woman.
Yeah. I'm not going to ask you why, but do you think it was because of that battle experience? Or?
Oh, it was definitely Vietnam. I mean, it was a post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah, I would fly into fits and rages, and for no reason at all. I can remember some of them like they were yesterday. Nothing she did. It was all me.
Now, this was a creeping disorder or disease?
I think it got worse for a period of time. I think it was building up till probably 75, that was probably the high point of my depression. After that, it kind of alternated between rage and depression. And okay. I was subjecting her to this.
Yeah.
We tried to get back together once, and I wasn't over the trauma yet.
What, was it thoughts or memories that would trigger it, or was it just a general overall reaction to civilian life? Or?
Well, I was having nightmares. I was waking up. I wasn't sleeping well, and most of the time, just for no apparent reason, something that somebody would say or she would say would just set me off. And I kept trying to tell myself that this was righteous indignation, and it wasn't. It was PTSD. I know that now.
When did you get diagnosed?
Didn't get diagnosed till 2005. I was in denial for 30-some years.
So you did not seek help?
Well, I divorced my second wife, and I didn't have any insurance. I went to the VA in Mountain Home, Johnson City, and I got to talking to one of the nurses, and she asked me some questions. She said, have you ever been tested for PTSD? And I said, no. She said, you need to be, because you've answered all these questions in a positive manner for PTSD. And I was at the point then where I'd been through two divorces. I was going through a lot of depression. I was willing to try anything. I said, okay, let's give this a shot, you know. It's cost me enough of my life. Let's give this a try.
Sent him home with what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. Mr. Jenkins, it affected your first marriage. You said you had a second marriage. But you were telling me a few minutes ago about your children a little bit. It affected your children. Can you tell us a little bit about how PTSD would affect children?
Well, after my first wife and I divorced in Hawaii in 75, I went for 10 years just by myself. PTSD is a series of mountain peaks and valleys. I got on a mountain peak. I met this lady. We hit it off. We got married. She told me she couldn't have any children. I said, well, you've never been married to a Jenkins before either, have you? She said, no. So we had a daughter. She said, I bet you can't do that again. I said, I bet I can. 13 months later, we had a son. My experience with my second marriage and my children was some good parts and some bad parts. My children experienced or lived with this PTSD through me in different ways. My daughter withdrew into her books, did good in school, went to Middle Tennessee State, graduated. But after she left home, she wouldn't speak to me for 6 years. My son went the other way. He withdrew, got into drugs. He's doing good now. I finally explained to my daughter one day, I said, you need to ask yourself, do you feel like that I was deliberately doing what I was doing and we lost a relationship? I said, I want you to remember this one thing. We're both victims of Vietnam, and we're getting back together now. We've had dinner together, lunch a couple of times. I've been over there taking some stuff to her. She lives over in Nashville. Like I said, my son got into drugs, had a problem with them. He's doing good now, though. He's doing real well. One thing I wanted to share with you that I think was very important to me was I asked him one day, I said, and this was back in the period of time when they were showing this, I guess it was a commercial on TV where this little boy's in a seat in a car. When his dad sticks his head in the window, he looks like a monster. And I was thinking about that when I asked my son, I said, what'd you think of me when you were growing up? I said, I need an honest answer. And he gave me an honest answer. He said, Dad, you were a monster. I needed to hear that. I suspected as much. But that's helped me more towards my recovery because I asked him a couple of months ago, I said, how am I doing? He said, Dad, you're doing better. That meant more to me than any military award or anything I can think of or any part of my recovery.
What do you think the cause of you doing better was?
Well, finally, after so many years, the VA finally decided they were going to give us some help with this PTSD. I started seeing a Dr. Gannon over at the VA hospital or a VA clinic here. She helped me a lot. She helped me to realize that I needed to get this out. I needed to talk about it. She asked me one day if I'd be interested in going into a group therapy. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, listen, I need that. I want that. So I got into a group with Dr. Richardson. And you get in this group, I've never been to AA or NA, but I would think it's something like this. You get in there with a group of guys that have been through what you've been through, and they tell a story about what happened to them, and you think, oh, I've been there, I've done that, I know what you're saying, you're telling my story. And when I'd tell mine, I could tell they were reacting that way, the same way. I've been there, I've done that, that's my story. And then you're in there for a period of 6 months or a year, and you see a guy that come in there They couldn't hardly talk without tears running down his eyes. And then you see him come in there one day and he's patting people on the back. He's asking you, how are you doing today? And you know in your mind and heart where he's been, what he's come through. That's part of your healing. That's part of my healing. And then someone would look at me and they'd say, you know, do you know where you've come from? I didn't realize I was getting better. That's part of the healing process. That's where those groups come in.
Well, Mr. Jenkins, where are you going with this now? You know, where are you taking this cure?
Well, we got out of the VA, and then we got into Vet to Vet, which is a national organization formed by a fellow by the name of Mo Armstrong. He had PTSD. They told him he was all right, go home, don't worry about it. And he said, that's not right. So we decided we're going to help ourselves. So here locally, we formed a group called Legacy Peer Support Group.
Right.
And it's patterned after NA and AA. It's like group therapy, only there's no clinician there. It's vet to vet. It's one vet reaching out to another vet, and it works. This is the message I want to get across to my veterans that are listening out there. If you think you've got a problem with PTSD, whether it's ruined your life or it's working on ruining it, I don't care what conflict you were in, there's hope, and there's help out there.
Who would they call? Who would they get in touch with?
Well, they can call J.L. Tucker, or they can go online at www.tnvhc.org.
And for listeners out there who, it's not that you have post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's in your family.
That's true.
Okay. You can call that number. What's that number again? 865. And briefly, tell me about what this outreach program is doing for you.
Oh, I've made marvelous success with this program. I've got to the point where we've actually divided the group into two sections there. One of them is a strength-based outreach, and the other is a Christ-based outreach. Now, I'm a facilitator. That's a little different than being a leader. We just kind of make sure that the program is going along. We maybe start it, let people talk, give everybody an opportunity to say what they need to say, maybe ask a person, you know, how do you feel about this? It's just helped me enormously. It actually got me back to thinking that if this group of guys can help me, I need to get back in the church, because the church is going to help me, because they understand where I've been in a Christian sense.
We've been talking today with Howard Jenkins, who started out as a 25-year-old man, went into the military, and experienced the difficulties of a battle that stayed with him all of his life. Made him, would you call it sick?
PTSD is a mental illness. It doesn't mean that you're crazy, but it means that you have problems coping with particular situations.
But you can use it to strengthen your missions and use it as a guide to help other.
That's right. If you use it properly and realize what your problem is, you can reach out to other people and help them. And that's what helps us, is helping other people.
We've had Mr. Howard Jenkins as our guest today, and he brought his friend, Mr. J.L. Tucker, who's spoken to us many times. J.L., what do you got to say?
Well, I would like to say I'm proud to have Howard as a friend. I've come to love him very much, and I love to hear him speak. And he's like me. He's very touched by everything. And I just enjoy being around him, among others, at Legacy.
Yeah, and we're going to be doing your story next week. And you have an interesting story, too, about experience you had with some helicopters. Mm-hmm. Was it during the Battle of Idrang?
Yes, sir.
And I hope everybody will be tuning into that.
Yeah, I'm getting my facts together on that.
Good. Folks, hope you enjoyed the show today with Howard Jenkins and his experience with post-traumatic stress disorder. You've been listening to The Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll see you next week.
Empty years behind me. It's good to know I'm not all alone. And it's good to have you back on the right side of the track. And it's good to have you back, America.